I'm going to talk about a few things. Hopefully I'll get to all of them by the end of the talk. In particular, I'd like to start off this talk with a derivation of the IPES multiscale models. IPES was derived by Rupert Klein and Andy Miner in a paper in 2003. And it's a multiscale model appropriate to connecting planetary and synoptic scale phenomena at the equator. And I'll explain how it is appropriate. And I think doing this derivation, at least I like to do the derivation because I like to think that it demystifies this whole subject. Because a lot of people, they hear asymptotics and stuff like that, my eyes blur when I look at a Wojtek flowchart of the different moist processes, and other people's eyes blur when they look at, if they see an epsilon or an equation. So hopefully I can at least explain how this whole thing works, and maybe at least you get a good impression of how it works. One of the points of the IPES is more general than the MJO model, and one of the points of the MJO model is that we see in through the IPES derivation that one of the essences that will create the features necessary that we see in the MJO are the upscale flux convergences from synoptic scales. And the neat thing about the way we approach the IPES model is that we can get explicit formulae for this. In particular, we can trace back different features that you see in the structure of the MJO to different features that you see on the synoptic scales. So the analytic formula, being sort of more mathematically minded, I really like the analytic formula because I think it gives you a sense of really what's going on. You can pin, you can really pin your hat on or whatever onto, very specific aspects of the flow. I'm going to talk about meridional momentum flux convergence, and this is something that came about between me, myself, Andy, and Mitch Moncrief when we started talking about what should these upscale fluxes look like. Are they due to vertical tilts in the heating, or are they due to meridional tilts in the heating? For those of you, I'll explain how that arises in terms of the fluxes by the end of this talk. I'm not going to talk about the transformative array by any means, but I will talk about how we implement Maida Akuita's three-cloud models in MJO. So hopefully some of that makes sense to some of you. So this is a talk that I give to mathematicians. So I always have to show them a plot of how I think of the tropics. So here's a water vapor map taken, I guess, from the site MSFC, NASA. Somebody else knows what that acronym means, I don't. NASA I do, but not MSFC. So you see, the idea is just to pin your eye on sort of a multiple scale structure that you automatically see in the water vapor signal right there. You see sort of these would be sort of mesoscale or maybe subsynoptic scale structures. And you also see sort of activity over the Indonesian marine continent there. And for this crowd, I probably don't have to throw a coordinated system on here, but what we're going to be working with is the equatorial beta plane, so definitely I don't have to talk about that. And I'm going to go through the derivation of the IPES model, starting with equatorial beta plane. We start off with anelastic, hydrostatic, equatorial beta plane equations. And how can I say this? I like to write equations as simply and elegantly as possible because I think if you write them simply and elegantly, you can actually see the solutions that kind of jump out at you. So maybe sometimes color helps in that.
But then it always looks like A of x equals 0.
Well, not that simply.
A of x equals 0.
Yeah, right. So Fjord hits a point. You have to have a compromise between too much and loss of information. So let's just stare at these equations for a second. U is the zonal velocity. V is the meridional velocity. Theta is, we're going to just work with potential temperature right now. On these large scales, I think we can talk about things about whether you want the equivalent moist potential temperature or whatever. But that's not important for the structure of how the multiscale asymptotics is going to work out. So it's going to be hydrostatic, and that's encapsulated in the pressure, the vertical gradient of pressure. And I'm just going to use anelastic, but in fact, when I actually solve these, I use the completely incompressible. So that's the anelastic result here, just that rho times divergence of rho times the velocity equals 0. Now, the first thing you got to do is you ask yourself, how do you approach this problem? You non-dimensionalize. And if it's appropriate to the equatorial beta plane, you have some natural parameters in the troposphere. You have some natural time scales, natural length scales that pop out of the problem. The natural time scale, as it is right now, you can see it's already been non-dimensionalized. Right? There are no parameters in this problem, except maybe n squared. But n squared's already been non-dimensionalized. It just allows for a vertically varying points of frequency. But you non-dimensionalize and you get natural time scale out of the problem. Time scale is 8.3 hours. It's the equatorial deformation time. You get a natural length scale of the problem. It's 1,500 kilometers, and that's sets the sort of synoptic scale in the tropics. So furthermore, this is a dry, we're going to just consider dry dynamics for a while, and you get basically a wave speed, a typical wave speed, your Kelvin wave speed, for the dry Kelvin wave speed, non-dimensionalized in this fashion. Well, it's 50 meters a second, so all the speeds, therefore, have been non-dimensionalized to 50 meters a second. All the velocities have been non-dimensionalized to 50 meters a second. Our vertical scale, which you know, is basically wrapped up in sort of your Kelvin wave speed and your buoyancy frequency, our vertical scale is 5 kilometers. And appropriate to that, I mean, you end up with a non-dimensionalization for the vertical velocity. And how that works is basically you want to ensure that the continuity equation on these scales has a balance between all three components of the velocity. And so that implies, just basically an aspect ratio thing, it implies that the vertical velocity has to be non-dimensionalized about a quarter meter a second.
50 meters per second for velocities is a thing.
I'm just writing the equations down. 50 meters, thank you. Rupert hit on the point. 50 meters for velocity is big. I haven't done the dive test derivation yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is just
that's actually the point, which is that as written right now, 50 meters a second for velocity is huge and therefore inappropriate to the problems we're interested in. On these large scales, you don't get average velocities above 50 meters a second in the troposphere. Furthermore, heating rates, if you non-dimensionalize the heating rate, right, the heating rate appropriate for this is 100 Kelvin a day, which is also very big. You know, we talk about average heating rates over synoptic scale. That's too big, right? So, and this is just measure the unit of the temperature fluctuations, so 33 Kelvin. The reason I do this is exactly to point out that I'm going to be throwing an epsilon in here. And when you throw an epsilon in here, a lot of people stop and say, well, you're just doing weak perturbations of something. You and I wouldn't say that, but other people might say that. And the point is, well, it's not weak perturbations because non-dimensionalized in this fashion, right, the velocity is 50 meters a second, right, the appropriate velocity is 50 meters a second. So really what you want is to consider much more terrestrial type velocity in the tropics, order 5 meters, 5 to 10 meters a second. And so that motivates, and furthermore, the heating rates of 100 Kelvin a day are far too big. So the point is, if you take a look at typical tropical synoptic scale heating rates, when you look at them, it's sort of Glynn and Johnson sort of have numbers that they back out, it's about 10 Kelvin a day. And you have these momentum dissipation time scales, et cetera. But in particular, this 10 Kelvin a day motivates the fact that, well, we don't necessarily want to consider order one forcings in this non-dimensionalization, but we want to consider forcings which are small. So as mathematicians, we slap in an order, we slap in an epsilon there and say that this epsilon is small, and as a rule of thumb, you throw epsilon as 1/10. I like to have 1/10, other people like to have larger numbers.
We're conservative.
We try to be as conservative as
possible. Rupert sleeps from his stuff.
Yeah. I try to be as conservative as possible.
Rupert says 1/7.
Huh?
Sorry, Rupert's more conservative.
Rupert's more conservative. It's hard to believe we're even more conservative.
He's German, can't he?
No, I'm more conservative.
A little more liberal.
1/7.
So, the idea is that these equations will have a forcing which is order epsilon. And so that's why, at some level, sort of the Matsuno-Gill model made sense. Because if you have a weak forcing in a nonlinear equation, well, the response is maybe linear, more or less linear, right? You can say the linear response is about right. But it's not sufficient. Matsuno-Gill model is not sufficient to actually getting... you want to say something?
No, I'm wondering if I should leave.
Okay. So the response to order epsilon forcing is order epsilon. Therefore, if you add your heating rates or typical momentum forcing on the synoptic scale of being order epsilon, which is 10 Kelvin a day, let's say for the heating rates, then you'll have an order epsilon response in the velocity field. And since the velocity field was in the original problem was scaled to about 50 meters a second, say epsilon is about a 10, it's about 5 meters a second response. So these are, that's, then there's, you know, Rupert's comment, which these are typical decent velocities, or a good unit of measure for the velocity in the tropical troposphere on synoptic scales. On synoptic scales. So let's make that clear. Okay? Furthermore, we don't necessarily, on synoptic scales, want to consider phenomena evolving on the 8-hour time scale. In fact, we were interested in doing a multiple time scales approach and a multiple length scales approach in this problem. And so, if you actually go through the asymptotics, you realize that you can get a second time scale, order, which is order 1 over epsilon times the original time scale. I think, did I do that right?
You did it right.
It's order 1 over epsilon times the original time scale, that is to say, at about 3.5 days, that's a time unit from what I would consider now my long time. That'll be the interseasonal time. That'll be the unit for measuring phenomenon, the interseasonal phenomenon. Furthermore, I've got 1,500 kilometers, and that's sort of going to be the inner length scale of my multiple scales asymptotics. That's the small length scale. And again, you can just go through the asymptotic procedure, and you'll see that you can get a long length scale, and a long length scale measures phenomena on the planetary scale, 15,000 kilometers. Okay. So this is all in Andy and Rupert's paper. I just describe it a little differently. I like to start with the inelastic equations. They started with the fully compressible Euler equations.
No, we did shallow water and fully compressible.
That's true.
We're in between in our work.
Yeah. That's right. They did do shallow water, sort of as a pedagogical example. But if you actually go through this procedure and scale everything down, you see that the equations, you just make a multiple scales ansatz, the equations break up into this very simple set of equations. Okay. So what does this set of equations say? Well, the terms on the left-hand side in blue, terms on the left-hand side over there, and this term and the terms in blue on the left-hand side, are simply the linear equatorial wave equations. So they have solutions, which are going to be the Kelvin waves, Rossby waves, and gravity waves, mixed Rossby gravity waves, inertial gravity waves, and mixed Rossby gravity waves. I have now canceled that epsilon out of the forcing term, so that I allow for some forcing, zonal momentum, meridional momentum, and some sort of heating rate. And I have an epsilon sort of, which encapsulates A, the nonlinearity, so I've rescaled everybody by epsilon, so you get an epsilon in front of the quadratic nonlinearities, you get an epsilon in front of the slow times, you get an epsilon in front of the derivative with respect to the long length scale, and then there's a bunch of other terms which I neglected. That's what all that means. I just neglect terms that are smaller than that.
Can I raise a small point here?
Please do.
I might be anticipating you, so stop me. There is, in the usual formulations of the meteorological equations, the drag terms, which are falling as units, are themselves nonlinear. And I'm wondering whether, and I think it's true, that nonlinearity in your scaling dominates over the nonlinearity that you explicitly written down. And so in the equilibration, you might infer that.
I mean, not on those length scales.
We have, in our menagerie of papers, they're all available on the website. There was a special volume of Dynamics in Atmospheres and Oceans, which Mapes and Collatus which just came out, and there we discussed the momentum boundary layer with nonlinear aerodynamic drag in this setup, and it's right in the same orders when you put in all the numbers with a standard boundary layer thickness of 500 meters and stuff.
Yeah.
It's consistent with all this weakly nonlinear setup. So we derived the equatorial equine drag and with nonlinear bulk aerodynamics. We're right there. Details are all there too.
How wouldn't it be there? I mean, if you could go and say your average will be,
but
I also want to give a different perspective on this, which is that if you're saying that your average momentum dissipation, your average momentum damping on scales, on synoptic scales, is greater than, orders, right, a factor of 10 greater than 5 meters a second a day.
No, that wasn't my point at all. My point is that if you are interested in nonlinear equilibration, what nonlinearity dominates that equilibration?
Right.
Yeah.
What I'm saying,
Carey so question was the bulk aerodynamic nonlinearity you thought might be more significant than all these.
Exactly.
And
right.
We showed
but
that
my point
not.
Is that if you, but one of the things that you, one of the ways to assess that, I was trying to say that one of the ways to assess that is to say what is your effective bulk drag on this on synoptic length scales? What is the magnitude of this term? Because that's, I mean, each of these things have a unit. And the unit of measure right now is 5 meters per second per day.
Yeah.
So if that drag is greater, order greater than 5 meters per second per day measured on those, average on those scales, then you may have a point. But my argument is that I don't think it is. So that's my point.
Self-consistently, it doesn't happen.
Right.
Sure.
So this is just a comment about what the solution is to the linear equation. Sure, why not? It's a discussion type topic.
You have two time scales in there.
Yes.
We didn't have that in the 2003 case.
You sort of did.
No, we didn't use them, but I have a fancier derivation, as you know, on the things I did with self-similarity. So we have the two time scales in.
It can be done. My question
we did it.
What exactly would you have when you wanted to do Klein-Meyer-Klein 2003 exactly? Which time scale goes away?
Oh, the fast
tau.
Tau.
Yeah, tau
goes away.
Zero.
Because when right, because the lowest order time scale goes away. Tau is measured in units of 8 hours.
Okay.
So that's the fast time scale. That's what goes away in Meyer-Klein.
Right.
And you guys consider balanced dynamics, which I'll get to in a minute.
Okay.
Sorry for the people who are, this is a bit of a lore. Some people really know this stuff, and obviously they're right here. And some people have never seen this stuff before, so.
And some of them are here as well.
No, everybody's seen this. So just for those of you who can't just spout off equatorial waves theory, the solutions, so this is a linear set of equations right here. The solutions to this, these blue terms over here, right, are the linear equatorial waves. And what are they? Well, this is horizontal wave number, so this is a dispersion relation versus frequency versus horizontal wave number. And what you have is, it's weird to preach to people who know this so well, but I have to say it anyway. You have a branch which are the non-dispersive Calvin waves. You have several branches of Rossby waves. These are traveling westward. Calvin waves traveling eastward. They're non-dispersive as wave number goes to zero. And that's an important feature. That's how you get that's how you get sort of the closure that comes about in this problem, that they're non-dispersive as k goes to zero. Then you've got fast inertial gravity waves up here. And they are filtered by in the long wave theory, which I will get to in a moment. And then you've got a branch of mixed Rossby gravity waves there. So the blue equation, the blue part of that equation, contains all of that information. Okay? So what we do next, or what Meyer-Klein did next, is actually go through an asymptotic expansion of the variables. And what they say is, consider that a forcing which depends on the slow time only, let's start with that. We're going to separate the variables into planetary scale means, green is chosen appropriately, and synoptic scale fluctuations. So it's a mean and fluctuations. The idea is that synoptic scale dynamics have a horizontal aspect ratio of 1:1. Okay? There's synoptic north-south, and there's synoptic east-west. Whereas the planetary scale dynamics are planetary east-west, but nonetheless confined by the equatorial waveguide to be synoptic north-south. Okay? So from linear theory of long Calvin and equatorial Rossby waves, you get the following scaling. What happens is that all these variables are order 1 in these new variables. So this is measured in 5 meters a second, 5 meters a second. And then you have the means, and the means are scaled as follows. These guys are the same order as their fluctuations. So those three are the same order as their fluctuation. And this is order epsilon, both V and W order epsilon. And the reason, just to give some intuition of how one comes about this, there's a lot of deep understanding of the problem to actually figure out how you scale the variables properly. But I would just say that the way that you understand to scale these variables properly is that in the limit that epsilon goes to zero, you want to recover the wave number goes to zero, the k goes to zero, omega goes to zero, eigenfunctions in the limit that epsilon goes to zero, because epsilon is also basically is a ratio of your length scales. It's like your wave number, your omega. And so you want to recover those eigenfunctions, and in that limit, these two components of the eigenfunctions vanish, and it's these three that remain. So, right, that took a long time to get through all that, but I'd like to hopefully keep people along with me as long as possible. So what do we do with the forcing? Now, as I articulated here, I always call this, and I say this with a little trepidation, a kinematic theory of the MJO. And I say that because...
It's a diagnostic theory.
A diagnostic.
A kinematic theory.
We have a different way of saying it, at least. But nonetheless, the idea is that we're going to apply the forcings that we see or sort of infer from observations to see if we can, from those forcings, get the structures that are seen in observations. Okay?
Can I phrase it a little differently?
Sure.
So since we have such a hard time getting the MJO, it's a subtle issue to decide how much of the MJO is produced from the mean heating on the planetary scales and how much is upscale transport. And we're trying to address that in this model by giving plausible observationally based models for what the observationalists think are for the fluctuating heating, for the mean heatings, and see what the upscale effects are and what are the planetary mean effects.
Yeah, I think that's a much more important way to put it than I did. I kind of just go through that very quickly.
Kinematics really is a put down.
I don't think it's that much of a put down. So in the heating, the we're going to basically focus on heating forcing. And that heating forcing is essentially, in our mind, it's latent heat release, okay? Condensational heat release. So what do we see? Well, one more aspect of the asymptotics is to recognize that, again, my temperature forcing, my heating rates, are going to have fluctuations, are going to have means. So means on the synoptic scales, horizontal means, which are going to be smaller than the fluctuations. Let's put some units to this. This is going to be measured in units of about 10 Kelvin a day, the fluctuating part. And this is going to be measured in like units of 1 Kelvin a day or a couple Kelvin a day. That's the unit for measuring these things. Okay. Furthermore, from the observations, and this is from Lin and Mapes, momentum and temperature dissipation follow linear damping, and they're damped at slower on the longer times. Because from the observations, people infer damping times of about 10 days, order 10 days. And so that's consistent with Schlepping and Epsilon up there. Okay? So you go through the asymptotics, boom, at the lowest order, you get an equation for the synoptic scale fluctuations. And it's the linear, again, it's the linear equatorial equations with forcings there, with forcings. So you have all those linear waves that I showed in, that those dispersive, those from the dispersion relation that I showed back there. Plus you have the possibility for balanced dynamics. Balanced dynamics arises if you just consider the time derivative equals zero solutions to this equation with some sort of forcing. Okay?
Time-dependent forcing in that case.
Fast time, yes, slow, right, exactly. Slow time forcing. Forcing which is very slowly. But you don't have to do it. It's nice because you get nice analytic solutions. I can write down the solutions. It's very easy to solve the fast time independent equations, and that's what Rupert was saying. That's sort of the theory that he was thinking about. And it's easy because you can just write the solutions down analytically and therefore infer the structures, that the fluxes that they give us.
Just to be certain about this, your S's are not themselves going to be functions of your dependent variables. They're just going to be specified.
At this point, they are going to be specified. What we are doing, and the fully nonlinear MJO model that we have, what we are doing is actually, do this properly and close the model by making S a function of those variables. That's how you do it properly, by adding more dynamics in there. So you're going to add, later, and if I get to it, I hope I get to it, I'll at least show you the equations. You write down the moisture equation. And so, the heating rate is going to depend on how much you condensate out. And then that's going to be dynamic variable also. Okay? So that's the synoptic scales. That's just the synoptic scale equations right there. So if we apply, and I'm going to be considering solutions where these guys are zero, the drags are zero at this order, and we can talk about, ultimately there's a whole hierarchy of scales, right? This is the synoptic scale equations, but there may be upscale fluxes from the mesoscales or from smaller scales also. And Andy sort of has a self-similarity theory that is essentially attempting to understand this whole hierarchy of scales. Okay. And then you go to the next order, and you get an evolution equation for the means. Okay? And here's the evolution equation for the means. Now, linear dynamics driven by mean forcing, mean heating. You've got those two damping terms that I talked about over there. And you got fluxes, F fu and f theta. Fu is basically, as the Reynolds stress, the flux of zonal momentum from the synoptic scale. So this over bar denotes time and space average, fast time and x space average, so that little x space average over there. And this is a upscale temperature flux from the synoptic scale. So without the Fs, and you just had an S and you imagine just doing some sort of heating, you basically get what looks like, you know, Gill's solution from his paper, right? The point of all of this is to recognize that if you do this consistently, you really get linear theory on the synoptic scales, and you need basically this nonlinear theory on the planetary scales, which has these
flux,
or quasi-linear, right? Quasi-linear because it's broken up this way. But I mean, I emphasize that it's nonlinear in the forcing. That's important. It's nice to break it up this way, but nonetheless, it is nonlinear in the forcing, in whatever S theta, the original S theta was.
Those forcing terms are functions of to be computed linear perturbation variables are not at this stage specified. Okay.
Specifying the heatings, the S primes.
Yeah. So I
we'll have
if
a model
I
for
if
the
I
S specify
these primes you see in those equations.
Yeah. So
yeah.
These U primes.
It would have been good if you remove time though, so they'd see that equatorial sphere drift balance and hydrostatic balance. Are you going to show the solution, Joe?
I was going to show the solution.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I was going to actually show the solution, Joe.
Okay.
So I'm going to object to your even remotely saying this is nonlinear, because it is linear in the planetary scales. It is a forced linear problem.
Joe, it's nonlinear in the following sense. It's in the technical applied math sense, it's quasi-linear. Take the synoptic scales, multiply by alpha, a string, S prime. Your solutions then impose a flux, Fu and F theta, on the large scales, which is alpha squared times what it was. So this is called, in technical jargon in plasma physics and applied math, a quasi-linear model. It's a non-linear model solved by two linear steps, but it has a non-linear feature.
And if I just may make a different comment, but Joe, I agree and I sort of disagree. But just to say, if I imagine I have some sort of forcing profile, let me call this X or T or whatever you want to call it.
Is this S prime?
Huh?
S prime?
Well, no, this is S. I'm trying to show a modulation.
Oh, you want to show the envelope.
I want to show a modulation. This is the full forcing. This is what I call S theta. This is the full forcing. Okay? And say this is the synoptic scale that I'm considering right here. And here it's modulating over the planetary scale. What I'm saying is the resultant solutions. The resultant solutions for the means, u bar, p bar, theta bar, they are not linear functions of s theta. If I were to double s theta, I do not double u, p, and theta. You don't. You change it in a weird way. Why? Because if you double the mean, so you imagine doing a window average of this, if you double the mean, and you only consider the mean, right? Like these guys, if you double the mean, yes, and you only have a mean forcing here, you will double this. But if you double the fluctuations, you'll quadruple this. So you have, you're adding the mean linearly, but you're adding fluctuations quadratically. In that sense, it's not a linear theory. In the sense that it's these equations are linear, that's true. But these guys depend, the fluxes depend quadratically. So it's linear in this term and quadratic in this term. So it's just generally, in that sense, it's not linear.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'll take your criticism.
Let me comment. Can drive it one step further. I mean, you said before, and Kerry emphasized that ultimately you want the source terms to be coupled to your variables. So the source terms on the small scale will depend on the mean winds that you have.
Oh yeah, of course, and that's
once you have that, the small scale model and the large scale model are non-trivially coupled, and those terms appear not as external forcing to the long wave.
They're right.
Fully non-linear.
Yeah. That's the end model that we're working on now.
But in that case,
this is a quasi-linear model. No. That's what we call it, quasi-linear.
No,
but it's not linear.
I'm objecting
mildly,
okay, to the fact that
we're using standard terminology of applied math and plasma physics and other physics communities. We're solving a nonlinear problem in two linear steps.
Surprised by is that diagnostically from this perspective. claiming that the Langevin oscillation is forced by any fluxes coming from a smaller scale, so that would be by the heating on the scale of the Langevin.
No, we're not saying that. What we're saying is there's a special heating on a large scale. And we will go and look at the observational record if he ever gets to it. I'm skeptical he will. And we will show which contributions of the observational record of the MJO are from mean heating and which ones are from eddy flux. Which eddy flux?
For the uninitiated, this is why this is really called the maddening Julian oscillator.
Okay, maybe we should move on to questions.
Yeah, sure. I'm a whole lot of that. Look, I'm glad that we have this discussion because hopefully, maybe it penetrates. And I'm happy to say that if you don't want to call it fully nonlinear, it's not a fully nonlinear problem. That's what asymptotics does. It allows you to break it up to hierarchies of linear problems, but it is nonetheless nonlinear in some aspect. The point here is now this is where you start squinting. Okay, don't look at this except to get a perspective of what's going on. The point about this slide, all it is to say is that if I am able to choose my S thetas in a certain way, well, I can choose them in this certain way, but what I'm going to do is basically now focus on first and second baroclinic, vertical baroclinic profiles. Because that is consistent in our idea, like sort of the main, you can capture the main heating in the Mitocooter model. It's essentially captures the three cloud types associated with these large scale phenomena. So I can write down general functions for the heating, first and second baroclinic mode, and it's in the balanced situation, set the time derivatives to zero on the synoptic scales, no synoptic scale time derivatives, you just get some sort of equation in terms of W in terms of S prime theta, and you see that this is the WTG solution, right? W is exactly the heating, right? And then whatever V, W, and P and theta are. But they are very nice functions in terms of first and second baroclinic, and they're linear. They are linear in the fluctuating heating. These guys are definitely linear in the forcing at that scale. Okay? But fact is, I can specify some analytic profiles, sort of eyeball something from the data, and come back and give you my W prime, V prime, U prime, etc. From there, I can then calculate the fluxes. Again, this is a squinting type slide. Okay? Don't look at all this stuff, this is just my notation. But the point is, all of these terms, these S1, 2s, and et cetera, they relate back to, there's basically bilinear operators in G1 and G2, and they relate to averages, horizontal averages, on the x and time, on the fast x, and if you need to, the fast time scale, of these g's.
There is no fast time scale.
Well, at this point, you've shut it off. And the point is, the fluxes, if you have a first and second baroclinic forcing on the synoptic scales, you have to get barotropic, first, second, third, and fourth. That's kind of obvious to anybody who knows anything about quadratic nonlinearities, but if you have 1 and 2, right, you gotta get 1, 2, 3, 4, and you gotta get their differences, all their differences of 1 and 2, which gives you 1 and 0. And that's how that comes about. But these structures depend on the shape of the heating. They're just encoding aspects of the shape of the heating. Okay, these fluxes depend on the shape of the heating on the synoptic scale. In particular, they depend on the tilts. Right? You get net upscale fluxes if you have a net tilt. Okay, and we know this from Rayleigh-Banach convection, right? You think about the sort of driving horizontal flows in Rayleigh-Banach. So again, all these structures depend on the tilts. Don't think about that. So the idea is that it's relatively straightforward to derive ADHESD in this fashion after you know the answer. The beauty is that we get these analytic expressions for synoptic scale balance dynamics, and the idea here is that we can trace which aspects, and this addresses Isaac's point, which aspects of the heating give you which aspects of the flow, of the planetary scale flow. So is it the planetary scale mean heating or not? So now we've got to talk about what the MJO is for at least 2 seconds. I'm going to give you the very fast talk through the MJO, because I think people would argue about what the MJO is too. But in our vision, the MJO is this large scale wind pattern.
Our vision, yes.
Huh?
Hendon and Salvi,
but the idea, the picture that we have in mind is the Hendon and Salvi picture here. So this is what you have. This is upper troposphere, this is a lower troposphere. The idea is that you have essentially this precipitation, the contours here is precipitation, here's Africa, here is sort of Indonesia. What you get ultimately, and maybe I'll just give a quick view of it, is you get organization of enhanced precipitation bubbling up over the Indian Ocean. That whole thing is propagates westward and ends up docking over the dateline. And associated with that, you get these very large-scale circulations. In this Hendon Salby picture, ahead of the precipitation, at least the lower levels, but at the upper levels, it's going to be cyclones. At lower levels, it's going to be anticyclonic behavior ahead of the precipitation. And behind it, at lower levels, it's going to be cyclonic behavior. Upper levels, it's going to be anticyclonic. So it's got a pretty strong, you know, first baroclinic vertical profile. And the idea is that we want to capture essentially these features and see which aspects of the heating we have to put in. Where do we have to put in different aspects of the heating? Okay. So my gosh, I've gone really late. So this is a picture of sort of a vertical slice of the winds in the MJO. One of the aspects of the MJO that's really important is that at the mid time of the MJO passing, you get a westerly wind burst at the base of the troposphere, very strong. The winds near the equator basically change sign. There's very strong westerlies. And we'd like to see that in our solution. So what do we do? Well, the vision that we have essentially from this picture from Lynn and Johnson, the idea is that you have congestus clouds leading the MJO and sort of deep clouds in the middle and sort of dominated by stratiform clouds at the back of a passing MJO envelope. And so essentially, we say, okay, let's put that in. This is a horizontal vertical slice of a heating profile that basically I call our canonical heating profile that we use to actually get our canonical MJO model. And what it is simply an idea that we have lower level heating, or lower mid troposphere, in the lower half troposphere, you've got heating concentrated. This is it's supposed to represent packets of congestus convection leading the center of the MJO activity envelope. Behind it, you have deep convection and sort of a tilt back, a vertical westward tilt associated with this is supposed to look like the anvil clouds in the back. But this is obviously not any individual cloud. These are synoptic scale structures. So this is, some people call it packets of this, right? So this is the net effect of packets of this. So superclusters is the word that some people use. I use that also a little fear because different people use that to mean different things. This is just a vertical slice of one of those packets. I don't think it gives actually much information. The idea is that if you take a look at one of those packets, and in particular, imagine you're sitting in that upward westward tilted flow right here. Sorry, imagine you're sitting right here and say, there's a bunch of these packets. What is the average effect of those packets? Now this is a meridional, and only look at the top picture here on the top left. This is a meridional vertical slice. So this is at the equator, and this is the full range of the troposphere. And what you see is that this is the zonal momentum flux. This is FU, the total FU that you get from such behavior. And what you get is...
You're standing in front of where you're pointing.
Sorry, thanks. What you get is basically downward flux of westerly zonal momentum. So you get zonal momentum. This is positive, driving positive flow here, so driving westerlies in the lower troposphere and easterlies in the upper troposphere.
And what's the horizontal axis?
It's y, latitude.
Okay,
latitude. Measured in units of the equatorial deformation. And this is for a particular heating that I threw in. But it was for those upward westward tilting packets. And the idea is that, if you just think about it, those tilts drive, shear. They essentially drive shear. Westerlies in the lower troposphere, easterlies in the upper. But that is my FU. That's going to be sort of the main FU. It also drives upscale transport of heat, of theta, but this is actually a lot weaker than the zonal momentum. You can see it's sort of a factor of 5 weaker than the zonal momentum forcing. And it actually turns out to be not nearly as important as the zonal momentum forcing. We can test that because you can shut it off. You can just put a model in there where you shut that off and see how much it affects the structure. So this is the structure that we get.
Are you going to talk about our mean
model?
Heating model?
Yeah, well, I was going to draw it, actually. So the mean heating model really sort of, the idea is that really you have imagine the center of an envelope here, and we have an envelope. This is a lot, you know, the envelope shape was borrowed from Gill, right? And what you have is congestus packets up here and deep stratiform at the back. Okay, that was reflected in that those heating contours that I showed you. But furthermore, you have actual mean heating associated with this. Okay, there's a mean heating associated with this whole thing. And it's not just these fluctuations, because the fluctuations would ultimately add to zero on the planetary scales, but what you have is the mean heating, which goes from as such. Mean heating, if I draw the this is supposed to be the troposphere now, slice over the equator of the troposphere, there's zero again. You have mean heating, which is basically concentrated in the lower troposphere down here, and the upper troposphere up there, and it looks like that.
And that's just the mean heating associated with congestus packets in the front.
Yeah, the idea is that it traces the congestus packets in the front, because the actual individual congestus packets that I drew had to have zero mean. So this actually takes into account sort of that you have a zero mean, so you're actually promoting the mean to higher order to this, to that epsilon mean heating that I was talking about. And here you have these stratiform packets over here. And so this basically says, well, this is tracing the mean of those stratiform packets, okay, which is weaker than the fluctuations. And so if you put that all in, again, you have a linear system in the end to solve. And the linear system, it's very easy to solve. I can even do that. And this is the resultant flow that you get. So this is at 0 kilometers, height in the troposphere, 2, 4, and this is above the midplane of the troposphere, 12 kilometers. And what you want to see here, this is north-south, this is east-west, and we have an envelope. The idea is that we can drive the heating ourselves, we can force it ourselves, and you just move that envelope forward as though to mimic the traveling MJO envelope. You get a westerly wind burst at the lower troposphere that tilts back with height. So in the up till the mid-troposphere, it tilts back with height. You've got sort of Rossby, these cyclones trailing, and anticyclones in the upper troposphere, so it's basically dominated by First Baroclinic. And you have anticyclones leading, and therefore cyclones in the upper mid, the middle upper troposphere.
But the main compelling feature is the westerly windburst also comes at the bottom.
Right, the westerly windburst comes at the bottom, it's strongest at the bottom, which I'll show in the next slide. Which I'll show in the next slide. So this is a contour plot of zonal velocity above the equator, height versus zonal extent. And what you see is this: the white corresponds to westerlies, and you see this very nice packet of westerlies coming in strongest. You can't really tell in this plot because I don't have the higher contour. Strongest at the base of the troposphere.
No, it shows right below.
Oh, right below here. Well, these are slices. There's too many plots to digest all at once. And you have easterlies above, and it's dominated by First Baroclinic, but First Baroclinic is not sufficient to capture the structure of this. In fact, what we show is that you need First and Third Baroclinic, in fact, to get all the nice sort of tilts that you see. And we believe, and in our opinion, this captures very well the structure, the observed structure of the MJO. Now,
we don't believe our paper documents in detail how it does.
Yes.
And which parts are mean heating and which parts are upscale.
And what I haven't said is that what our first paper does is tease apart the different aspects of it. So you have meridional momentum flux, vertical momentum flux, meridional temperature flux, vertical temperature flux, and mean heating. Since it's linear in each of those pieces, I can shut each one off and say, oh, you need this, you don't need that. This is what this gave you. This is what that. That's what we do. And what we basically show, and the main part, I think, of at least our first paper, is we show that you need mean heating, but you also need upscale vertical flux. And yes, I only have 5 minutes left. That includes discussion? No? So, you know, I can talk about super rotation, or I can talk about...
super rotation.
You want me to talk about super rotation, but they were asking about the nonlinearities. I want
the
to talk about moisture.
The problem is... There are some people who care about it. There are some world experts in super rotation in the audience. It's a worthwhile thing to try it out.
Okay, so I'll try it out.
We have a theory for super rotation in MJOs with Mitch Moncrief based on this.
This is the part that we did with Mitch Moncrief. And, you know, I'm not an expert on super rotation. We started talking to Mitch, and we just asked him, what is this super rotation that's apparently observed during an MJO event? And can you see it, or do you see it in the models, in our MGO models? And the first thing we did was sit down and just say, diagnose, what is the superrotation? The superrotation, it has to be due to meridional flux of zonal momentum. Superrotation is if the equator, net winds at the equator, the vertically averaged, horizontally averaged winds at the equator are westerlies, are net westerlies, okay? And so you need a meridional flux of momentum to get that. Now, if you just analyze the model, you see that the total meridional flux of momentum has two components. It has a component that's from the upscale fluxes of from the synoptic scales, and it has a planetary scale component, which is, there's an epsilon here, because it's a little weaker. So this would correspond, this would drive the divergence, the meridional divergence of this would drive the would drive westerly winds, the negative divergence of that. Now, what we, this I can put into the model explicitly. I can say, well, I can get UV correlations if my heating is tilted meridionally. Right? That's what I was saying before, is that this is what you sort of, you put in a heating, but that heating has a shape. The shape of the heating sort of is one-to-one related to the U prime, V prime, the upscale fluxes. If it's meridionally tilted, I get a net flux. This, I then have to analyze based on whatever that heating was, right, and whatever my mean heating was. And so we did a few experiments. We said, well, just analyze what that term is in the MGL model, our canonical MGL model. And what you see is that this is latitude, this is, it's UV, and I got in Newton meters per second, but it's really, it should be like a rho UV or something. What I want to show is that what you get in our MGL model is actually a negative derivative of this, UV. The negative derivative implies that, if you imagine, negative d by dy of UV, that's d by dt of U. That's the, that drives mean zonal velocity, so that if you just imagine through a conservation law. And just in our simple first MJL model, our canonical MJL model, you get what driving westerlies, you get the super rotation drive at the equator. And what this is, it's fluxing momentum clearly from just slightly higher latitudes, right? So within the equatorial waveguide, but from higher latitudes to the equator. And we said, well, what happens if you change those meridional tilts, those U prime V primes, and consider the fact if you added sort of a westward meridional tilt there. If you add a westward meridional tilt, you get a different flow profile. You can play this game with lots and lots of tilts. And what you see is that at the equator, just look at the solid curve at the equator, again, you drive westerlies here, but in particular, these tilts, these on the synoptic scale, drive a much broader set of westerlies.
They're now meridional tilts, too.
But this has meridional tilts on the synoptic scale.
If I understand, you're saying if the angular momentum, total angular momentum exceeds zero angular momentum off the equator, then you could flux that to the equator and get super rotation. Is that what you're saying?
No.
It's not just transport. You're just, so
it's
you have
like a rearrangement of angular momentum.
Pardon me?
It's like rearranging, right?
Yeah, but that's not what you're doing.
Well,
I mean, if you drew the sort of angular momentum profile prior to super rotation, what would that look like?
Well, these are deviations, right? So
yeah.
These are supposed to be considered deviations from the mean, from whatever climatology you have. So yeah, I'm not really using.
Yeah.
I'm using net zero background.
Yeah, I think what's puzzling to some extent is that you want super rotation at the equator.
Mm-hmm.
Now the mass that you have available with some other zonal momentum will typically have less zonal momentum. Off the equator towards the equator, it actually slows down because of
conservation. Right.
So why is a meridional flux speeding stuff up?
What we're going to show is it's not going to play a role. So we had one without a meridional flux. Our canonical MGL model right here doesn't have a meridional flux, and it still has super rotation.
Yeah.
So
what I'm saying
is flux isn't the cause.
Absolutely not. That was Mitch Mockry's first guess and everyone else's guess.
I thought you were telling me that it
was.
No. I mean, there's got to be some. Nah. The point is, if you
and this is the proof of principle, because we have no meridional momentum.
Vertically,
so we got super rotation at the equator.
This is sorry guys, this is tough for 5 o'clock in the winter. Hold on a little longer. I just see people falling asleep. If you use only vertically integrated momentum, right, you get some term like this. This is sort of the term you get, right? The point is, terms, however, are, you know, they, this is just something sloppy that I wrote down. These terms have multiple scales. There's a U prime, a V prime, a U bar, a V bar. They have dynamics to them that come from the dynamics that I specified, right? That dynamics is forced by heating, right? The question is, do you require meridional tilts on the synoptic scales to get this sort of super rotation? And the answer actually that I come to, and I actually have an analytic argument in the paper that Andy and I wrote with Mitch, the answer that I come to is you don't. And this is something I want to show right here, is that if you just had meridional tilts on the synoptic scale heating, right, just meridional tilts on the synoptic scale heating, and you just do this argument, you know, just go through and say, what's the flow? Here's the flow. Here's one that we thought was somewhat plausibly like an MJO-ish structure, right? But if you ask what its UV, its total UVR, right, what you find is its total has no gradient at the equator, has no gradient at the equator. And that means that there's no net drive from those tilts. What you get a drive from, and this is what I think we're all, oh, and furthermore, if you have eastward meridional tilts alone, right? So you add, sorry, you do put eastward meridional tilts and some sort of heating, some sort of mean heating. So you've got fluctuating heating with eastward tilts and mean heating. What you find is that, well, the eastward tilts out in the wings here at higher latitudes drive sort of eastward, right, eastward flow kind of thing.
Westerly flow.
This is, it's westerly in the, you still drive westerlies at low latitudes near the equator. You still drive westerlies near the equator. And the point is, and the analytic argument that I have, and I'm sorry that I went through this so quickly, but I went through everything else so slowly, the analytic argument that I have is very simple. It's basically that you can show sort of systematically how you can get a net, what are the terms that give you a sort of a U bar, V bar in this whole theory. And the terms that give you a UV bar are terms that require, you know, there's basically you can do a Taylor series expansion in latitude, and you find that the lowest order term in a Taylor series expansion is proportional to the mean heating, which is S, times, this is just an amplitude here, now I've written it, times momentum flux, which is F, a vertical momentum.
Vertical.
In fact, what you need to generate this super rotation at the equator, is a correlation between the correct sign of heating and vertical momentum flux. So to get convergence near the equator, you need this SF, because you need basically this whole UV has to be negative. So this SF has to be positive, which means you have heating at the equator plus westward tilted animals. In other words, our canonical MJO model.
So
and if you know obviously the opposite sign changes that, and you don't get that super rotation signal.
Joseph, can I say one thing right now?
Please.
Because there's a kind of interesting philosophical thing in the way we use the model. What we did was our first model that had no meridional momentum fluxes had some super rotation in it. Then we said, can we match Wojtek's super rotation in his super parameterization MJL? One of those matched Wojtek's fluxes, where you saw the things with big lobes for meridional stuff and then something smaller. Then we said, let's take four or five models and play with everything and pretend we're physicists and argue what's the universal thing about them. They all had super rotation. And they all had super rotation from the meridional momentum flux. Then Joe came up with this nice analytic support. So it's the vertical tilt. It's the vertical tilt, not the meridional tilts that drive equatorial super rotation. And upscale transports correlate.
You see from this term, it's a correlation of vertical tilt.
Correlation of those two.
You need those two things simultaneously. If I did this and I showed the meridional tilt, it doesn't give you anything proportional to y at the equator. In other words, it has no net convergence or divergence. It has no net flux convergence or divergence. So you need vertical tilt and you need mean heating in order to generate this.
But that UV over bar contains the edge terms, right? Or you're not talking about U bar, V bar.
The total UV bar contains the eddy terms plus this. But if I don't have, I can show that those eddy terms are actually, they always vanish at the equator. The meridional eddy flux always vanishes at the equator, and it's a consequence of the temperature gradient flux.
But the U bar and the V bar have the upscale eddy fluxes in them of momentum, from vertical momentum processing them.
Yeah.
So when you do their vertically integrated averages, then they can have a contribution from the eddy flux. And that's Joe's analytic expression.
I don't claim that this is obvious. I mean, it wasn't obvious to us. It's not obvious to me. I think there's a little subtlety here, actually.
Well, the reason that I'm a little confused is maybe I'm misunderstanding where the eddies come in, because at some level you need the
yes, and here's where the eddies come in. The eddies come in, they drive U bar and V bar. That's what we showed. Then to check for super rotation, we have to assess the contributions from U bar, V bar, vertically integrated, and the contributions from the eddies. There's our formula.
Mm-hmm.
What
this contribution will only occur if your synoptic scale heating has a meridional tilt in the first place.
Right.
However, this contribution, its convergence, will vanish at the equator.
So
it's lower order.
So
you're left with
U bar V bar
is dominant contribution. Then, if you look at Joe's analysis, then of what leads at the origin, U bar V bar reflect the eddy fluxes of momentum, and they reflect when you do the analysis he just did, and you expand at the equator, they reflect the eddy fluxes of momentum and the heating. And if those two, you have positive heating and the right eddy momentum flux sign like we had with our tilts, then you get super rotation.
You're not violating my theorem in any sense.
Absolutely not, because we have eddy fluxes driving this mean.
Okay. Right.
I that's a very good question. Everyone always asks this. Are you violating Hyde's theorem? We're not, because we have eddy fluxes incorporated in U-bar automatic right now.
So thank you for your attention. It's a long discussion.